from continuous variable systems. And in particular, these protocols are going to be, they're going to Gaussify the input states. And we're going to see that the reason why they Gaussify is due to something called a non-commutative central limit theorem. So this is work between me and Jens Isert originally in this PRL, and then we extended it and generalized it and added some more bits and bobs in this archive that's going into PRA soon. And yet in the background, you can see the group at the Freie Universität. So the first three slides, I'm going to give you an outline of the talk. And so the first outline slide is essentially an instance of the family protocols that I'm going to describe to you. And so these protocols, they take input states. So in this instance, two copies of rho n shared between Alice and Bob, which are going to be non-Gaussian and weakly entangled or partially entangled. And I'll explain what I mean by Gaussian and non-Gaussian also in the first third of the talk. And then the outputs of the state become progressively more Gaussian and more entangled. Okay, and the protocols only use linear optics. And again, I'll explain what linear optics means. So the first third will largely consist of a soft introduction to continuous variable optics and then introducing the protocols. And then in the second part of the talk, I'm going to describe to you how non-commutative central limit theorems fit into the picture. And so for now, just so you have some idea what I mean when I say central limit theorem, I'll just give you a short description of what a classical central limit theorem is. So a classical central limit theorem tells you about the probability distribution when you take samples from a population. So consider random variables, which we'll label, say, xj. So a random variable, for example, is the height of a person in the world. Yeah, and so this can have any distribution you want. And then we consider another random variable, sn, which is a renormalized sum over n different random variables. So, for example, it's the average height of n people. Yeah, so you take a sample of n people, you work out the average height, and then you do this over and over again. And then you look at this distribution. And so for these sampling distributions, if you look at the characteristic function, so the characteristic function is the expectation value of the exponential of the random variable times t. So it's essentially the Fourier transform of the probability distribution. And so we look at this because this is easier to study. And then you can later on make conclusions about the probability distribution itself. And so the characteristic function will, as n increases, approach a Gaussian where this thing here, gamma, is the variance of the original distribution. So the variance stays the same, right, as n increases, but you get a Gaussian shape, a normal distribution, yeah? Yes. Sorry.
And little t and little r, but little r in that case, and you mean little t, which is the variable.
Yeah, I changed half these equations earlier today. So yeah, this should be quite correct. This should be t, and the little n should be big n. So assume that this is the characteristic function for x1. And then as n increases and we look at S2, S3, S4, then this is the sequence that you see. So it becomes more Gaussian and maintains the same variance as the original distribution. Okay? So, and then in the third part of the talk, I'm going to talk about applications, how this is used for distilling entanglement, and then quantum repeater networks. So quantum repeater networks are setups whereby you want to share entanglement some big distance, big L, but as you try and distribute the entanglement, there's lots of noise, and you reach a point where the state becomes separable, so you have to stop at some shorter distance and then try and distill the entanglement and swap it across in order to reach that longer distance. Yeah? Okay, so basics of, let's just fix the notation. So for a single continuous variable mode, we have the Fox basis, which everyone's familiar with. It's generated by this creation operator. And then if we have many different modes, which may be different spatially, different frequency, different polarization, then we label that with a subscript J. And then creation annihilation operators from different spatial modes will commute. And then important observables in this space include, say, X and P, which are like position and momentum of a simple harmonic oscillator, or the electric magnetic field strength of the electromagnetic field. Okay, so the quantum version of the characteristic function, so our phase-based description, is we take our rho and then we work out the expectation value, so the trace, of rho times this unitary operator here, which is a bit like a unitary version of the, like an operator version of the Fourier transform. So we've replaced the random variables that we had in the classical picture with x and p operators, yeah? And then the Fourier transform, so the standard Fourier transform of this characteristic function is the Wigner function, which we mentioned because many people are familiar with the Wigner function because it's a quasi-probability distribution, but not familiar with the characteristic function. But it's actually easier for us to work with the characteristic function, okay? So the moments of a state are the first moments of a state are just the expectation values of these, hang on, maybe I didn't make this clear. So I'll use the notation R subscript J to pick out elements of this vector of operators. So the first moments are just expectations of values of X and P. Without loss of generality for the rest of the talk, we just assume that these are always zero. All of the interesting stuff is in the second moments. So we consider a matrix of these moments, which is just so RJ times RK plus with them swapped around. And this captures interesting things like entanglement. Okay, so we say a state is Gaussian if and only if the characteristic function is quadratic. And in particular, it's quadratic with this form here where you have gamma acting on R and R transposed, acting on the other side, right? Where gamma is, again, the covariance matrix for rho, the covariance matrix of the second moments. And then equivalently, if the characteristic function is Gaussian, then the Wigner function is also Gaussian, so saying that the Wigner function, so examples of Wigner functions include the vacuum, the squeezed vacuum, where the variance is bigger in one direction than the other, and also the coherent states, which are just displacements of the vacuum. Okay, so Gaussian unitaries are unitaries which preserve the set of Gaussian states, and they all have the form of u raised to e to the I ht, where h is something that's quadratic in these annihilation creation operators. In fact, we'll only really be using linear Gaussian operations, which are like the beam splitter unitary that consists of one dagger and one creation and one annihilation operator. And throughout the talk, we'll illustrate that with this kind of picture here. We have two input ports and then some beams, some crossover and then outputs. But many no-go theorems that I'll mention will also be well-defined for nonlinear Gaussians, such as squeezers, which give you the squeeze states, and displacers, which give you the displaced vacuums. Yeah. Okay. So it's important. Yeah, Gaussian unitaries are important because, in some sense, they're easier to perform in the laboratory than general unitaries. So, okay. So the kind of measurements we'd be interested in when I say Gaussian measurements, I mean measurements such as homodyne measurements, where you measure, say, X or P, which can be achieved by taking the signal, mixing it on a beam splitter with some reference laser. The phase of this determines whether you measure X or P or some kind of combination of these. But then also you have another set of measurements such as eight-port homodyne measurements. So an eight-port homodyne measurement is essentially kind of two homodyne measurements, one in X and one in P, but where you've split the state, so half of it goes this way and half of it goes this way. And then what you end up with is some information about X and some information about P. And on balance, this gives you a set of POVM elements, which are the set of displaced vacuum states, so some overcomplete basis of states. Okay, so I've discussed Gaussian unitaries and Gaussian measurements, and all of these have some simple effect on the covariance matrix after they've been applied. But more generally, we can consider all possible Gaussian maps, right? So by Gaussian maps, I mean a channel, a completely positive trace preserving, sorry, a completely positive map, not necessarily trace preserving, such that if P is Gaussian, after I applied the map, I always have something that's Gaussian, right? So I always have a Gaussian state afterwards. In particular, if rho has a covariance matrix gamma, then the covariance matrix of rho prime is this thing, gamma prime. So this expression here is called a Schur complement and comes from performing a Gaussian integral. And here you have gamma prime, which is what you got afterwards. Here you have the initial covariance matrix. And then these small gammas are covariance matrices that come from the choice state isomorphic to the channel. Yeah? So if you don't know what I mean by that, it's not important. Just these are some covariance matrix that describes the channel. Okay, so given these definitions, I'm going to tell you about two small interesting theorems about Gaussian operations and Gaussian states before I go on to describe our protocol. So the first one is the extremality of Gaussian states, right? So first of all, we note that for any quantum state, there's a Gaussian state which has the same second moments. And if you compare that Gaussian state with all of the states, also including all of the non-Gaussian states which have the same second moments, then often the Gaussian one turns out to be extremal in some respects. So for certain functionals, it'll have a minimum or a maximum value for that functional, right? So in particular, it was shown in this paper by Wolf et al. That for any entanglement measure or any other kind of functional that is strongly superadditive and continuous, so I can tell you what these mean later if you're more interested, but assuming modulo some assumptions, the entanglement of a non-Gaussian state with the same second moments as rho g is always greater, right? Okay, so examples of E that have the desired properties include the squashed entanglement or the distillable entanglement. Interestingly, actually, neither of these do we know how to calculate. And none of the entanglement measures that actually satisfy these properties do we actually know how to calculate analytically or even numerically. Okay, and also another reason why I mentioned this extremality principle is that the proof technique uses similar central limit techniques to what I'm going to describe. And so I'll mention again this extremality principle later on. So the next theorem that I want to tell you about that's known, which was covered in these three papers, are a set of various no-go theorems that tell you what you can't do with Gaussian operations. So in particular, they roughly say that entanglements cannot be distilled from Gaussian states using only Gaussian operations. So what do I mean by cannot be distilled? Well, let's take the definition from this reference three here. So this paper shows that there exists an entanglement measure, which has a slightly odd property. It's very, very, very subadditive, which is that, say, Alice and Bob share many, many states, say row one, row two, which may or may not be the same state, or they can be different states. So they have many, many states. Then the entanglement of the joint state is equal to just the maximum value of any one of these pairs, right? And furthermore, after you apply any Gaussian channel to a Gaussian state, for this entanglement measure, it has to be smaller than or equal to the original state, right? So say you've got n copies of a state, yeah, with entanglement, with some amount of entanglement, then that's the same as having one copy initially, right? And then you apply some channel which might just spit out a single two-mode state, and the entanglement of this still cannot be greater than that amount. Yeah?
Hey. So here you're talking about Gaussian LOCC?
Like local Gaussian, yeah, sorry. I should have said local Gaussian maps. You're right. Yeah. Okay, so in order to say anything interesting about entanglement distillation, we have to somehow circumvent this no-go theorem. So there's a well-known protocol which comes from these two papers and several other papers that consumes non-Gaussian states. So this is how it circumvents the theorem. It just says, let's assume we have some non-Gaussian states, but let's only use Gaussian operations and see how far we can get. And this protocol outputs Gaussian states, but to me, at least reading the original papers, it's not clear why. Why the output states become more Gaussian. The entanglement can go up, and it uses projections onto the vacuum, and it is recursive. So you'll understand what recursive means in the next slide. So the extension of this kind of single instance of a protocol to a whole family of protocols that we propose offer many different Pelosi selection strategies with various advantages that I'll describe to you as we go through. And also non-recursive variants, which I'll explain to you in the next couple of slides.
So, okay. To be clear here, in the protocols you'll be presenting, your goal is to distill entanglement. The fact that it becomes Gaussian is a side effect. That's not something you want.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess there's also some merit for saying that the protocol outputs something that's Gaussian, because say you had some protocol that guaranteed you that it gave you a state that was more entangled, but gave you no other guarantees on what the state could be, so it could be quite non-Gaussian, then it's not clear that you would always be able to use this protocol to prepare a state that had the kind of right kind of entanglement for what you wanted to use it for afterwards.
There might be another sense in which it's worse, because if you're constraining yourself to Gaussian operations, then Gaussian entanglement can't be used to violate a bell inequality. But if you had non-Gaussian entanglement, you could. So in a sense, non-Gaussian entanglement in the context of Gaussian operations is a more powerful resource than Gaussian entanglement.
Yeah. You can, though, even though you can't violate Bell inequality, assuming you don't care about device independence, you can still do crypto. So there are still some kind of practical applications. That's really kind of the main application I think you would have in mind with any of these kinds of schemes, is trying to do quantum crypto without worrying about device independence. Oh, and there's another thing that I forgot to mention here, which is a plus of our way of seeing things is that we have an explanation of why there's gaussification. It's less mysterious than in the earlier papers, because it's closely related to these non-commutative central limit theorems. Okay, so what do I mean by a recursive protocol? So recursive protocol, this is the same picture that we saw earlier. So we have rho n, which is typically non-Gaussian. And then we mix on a 50-50 beam splitter. So in the recursive protocols, we always set beam splitters to be 50-50. Then Alice and Bob implement a measurement, which is a POVM, which is proportional to a Gaussian. Also, it has to be local because it's implemented by local detectors. And then we label the output state rho 2n, right? And then it's recursive because we repeat, then we basically do exactly the same thing. We just double the number of inputs, and then we again measure the same POVM, and then we label the output 4n, subscript 4n. So the subscript here is counting the number of inputs. Yeah, and it's also useful to use this maybe slightly non-conventional subscript notation for the next slide. So here I'm describing pumping protocols. So a pumping protocol is one where you take rho n and then just rho 1. So this is the raw input state that you start off with. And we mix on a beam splitter that this time has to have a reflectivity that's tuned. So we call it pumping because we continually pump with rho 1. So the entanglement from rho 1 is continually pumped onto rho n. And then we label the output rho n plus 1. So again, here, the subscript labels the number of states that we've consumed. Yeah. So the advantage of this scheme is arguably that you only ever need to have a memory for two modes, right? For two copies of the state. You run this protocol once, and then you prepare a new rho 1, and you run it again. Whereas with the previous scheme, the recursive scheme, this tree-like structure ensures that you need to have an exponentially growing memory capacity. However, conversely, the disadvantage is that you need to run this for a longer time, just because you need to consume the same number of copies to get the same eventual output. So what I'm saying is that you have the previous papers just describe the recursive protocol, but here you, using our formalism, you can move back and forth between either favoring memory capacity as a restrictive resource or time. Okay, so I'll list all of the requirements on Pi. So it must be, the POVM must be Gaussian. An aspect of our proof is that it must be invertible. But that's not too big a restriction, because only the Gaussian projectors are not invertible, right? And also, it must have vanishing first moments.
What do you mean by invertible here?
None of the eigenvalues are zero.
And then you said only the Gaussian
projectors.
So every
Gaussian state is proportional, is unitarily equivalent to a thermal state, a thermal Gaussian. So if it's zero temperature, then it's a projector. But if it has any finite temperature, then it will look like it'll be proportional to sum over some constant to the power of n, and then project onto the nth state. So that eigenvalue will always be non-zero, as long as it's not a projector. That's kind of important. You can kind of see why that's important in the next slide, because the key trick in our analysis is that instead of studying rho n, because this proves to be quite difficult, we look at some different object, tau n, which is rho n, but with the square root of this P over M on either side. Yeah. So because we're only studying this, we need to know that we can recover the state from any conclusions that we make about tau n. If pi isn't invertible, then knowing what tau n is doesn't tell us anything about rho n. But knowing that it's invertible guarantees that knowing tau n, we know what rho n is. Okay, so I won't go through the algebra, but there's a very, very simple relationship for the characteristic function as n goes up. So the characteristic the characteristic function of tau n just is the characteristic function of the initial tau, but with a factor of root n and then raised to the power of n, right? So whereas this is very simple, the formula for the characteristic function for rho n is quite involved. So that's the trick. It's just look at that object. And then by a non-commutative central limit theorem.
Sorry, I just want to clarify. I presume by pi here, you mean the Gaussian measurement on one or the other side, that this is the local
Gaussian projector. No, this is the projector. Okay, so this is the projector for both of them, but because it has to be local, then it will have a tensor product. So you'll have like pi is equal to pi a tensor pi b.
I see.
Yeah. In fact, we don't use that fact at any point in this proof that this pi here is separable. That's only a constraint that you add on because you're interested in entanglement distillation. If you're interested in Gaussification for some other reason, then the results would still hold. In fact, one thing that I'll comment on later is that there are possible applications for these techniques in the single mode case where there's just no such thing as entanglement. Okay, so I don't want to give you the full proof of how the central limit theorem works, but again, we see that basically this characteristic function goes to something Gaussian. So here are the references, and I can go into more detail at the end of the talk if you want for why this works. So when we say the characteristic function goes to a Gaussian, what we mean is that if you pick an R, then if you pick any point in phase space, and you set an error, so a difference between these two values, then I can find an n such that for all n bigger than that critical value, you're epsilon close for that particular point. Okay. So furthermore, we also know that there's a trace norm convergence, and this last condition, which is weaker than trace norm convergence, just that for any bar and ket, you know that this value here goes to zero as n goes to infinity. So even though this is weaker than this, I mention it because we're going to use it on the next slide. Okay. So again, this is just a reminder what tau n is. We know how tau n behaves. It's very simple. But we want to now make some conclusions about rho n. Okay. So we know that tau and rho g are related by this map, right, which is Gaussian, because it's just simply p of because this operator here is Gaussian. And so we know that there's a relationship between their covariance matrices. So we have this formula here, which we saw earlier. So what are the knowns in this formula? Well, we know what this is. It somehow describes the initial state. And then we know what these small gammas are, because these describe are an alternative description of this P over M element pi. Okay, but what we really want to know is this thing here. So obviously we can just solve for this, and we end up with this kind of final expression, which in my mind is fairly simple given the complexity of the problem. So this is always true assuming that there are various matrix inversions that you have to make through solving from here to here that exist. Okay, so we know that if rho n does converge to a certain state, what covariance matrix it will have. But that doesn't actually guarantee that the fact that tau n converges to tau g will entail that rho n will converge to rho g. You don't automatically inherit the convergence. Okay. So what can we say about convergence? Well, this is the formula that we had a few slides ago, which is just that for any matrix element of the difference of the two taus, it goes to zero. So pick a basis, psi j, which is the eigenbasis of this of the P of M that we're using, right? Then using this basis, we know that, so just plugging in what tau is, we know that this is true, that that these matrix elements disappear. Okay, but these are eigen, these are eigenvectors of this operator, so we can just replace the operator with numbers. Yeah? But it's the same, it was the same for tau g and tau n, so then we can just cancel these numbers. Right? So now this almost looks like saying the matrix elements of rho g converge to those of rho n. But the problem is you have this funny denominator which may or may not be the same. So the whole problem of whether Gaussification protocols work or not can just be reduced to the statement that assuming these expectation values converge, then the matrix elements converge. And then one can also go on to prove that this would in turn entail trace norm convergence, convergence infidelity, and basically convergence in any respect that you would ever desire. Okay, so this is really the key thing. Everything boils down to whether these two things converge to the same fact, whether this converges to the, this value or not, right? So if you consider the difference of these two values, then you might want to try and say upper bound and lower bound the difference. And it turns out that one of these directions is easy. You can always upper bound it. And this is a proof that is generally true for all possible states and all protocols. But surprisingly, they do exist. And this was something that was missed out in earlier papers, kind of exotic states or exotic protocols where the expectation value of the P of M disappears. There may even be cases where it converges to some other non-zero value that isn't the correct one. And in these cases, the sequence of states don't converge to anything. They just diverge. So the state just, for example, acquires more and more energy. Okay, so what do I have to say about this? Well, we have some sufficient conditions for when these problematic things don't happen and when the expectation value of pi doesn't indeed converge. But these are quite lengthy to explain, so I'll skip them for brevity. Okay, so I just want to pause for a moment and recap what we've gone over, and then again repeat what we're going to do in the last third of the talk. Okay. So I've given you a review of the CV formalism, and I've outlined these recursive protocols, which are similar to the ones that we've had before, and these pumping variants that require less memory. And I've showed that the Gaussification phenomena in these protocols is driven by a non-commutative central limit theorem. Okay, so in the rest of the talk, I'm going to discuss how you pick the P of M and how your choice of P of M influences how successful you are at distilling entanglement. And then I'm going to say a little bit about quantum repeaters and other possible applications of these techniques. So, as I said, what we outline is a whole family of protocols. One particular family is one that interpolates, so a subfamily of the family that I've defined, interpolates between these kind of vacuum projection protocols, and you could also interpret the protocols that are used in the proof of the extremality principle as protocols where you set pi is equal to the identity. So in the earlier vacuum projection protocols, we see that this Gaussification entanglement goes up, but it really succeeds. So by really, I mean that so it will succeed with zero probability if you try to implement a vacuum projection using a homodyne detector. But you can use photon resolving number detectors to get a non-zero probability. But even then, the probability of success could be small, right? So conversely, if you run the Wolf et al. Protocol, you'll also see Gaussification, but the entanglement for certain measures of entanglement would decrease, but it always succeeds. So we want to see if there's kind of like a happy medium in the middle, right, where you can basically choose what success probability you're happy with or what entanglement you're happy with, and then see what the other.
So early, you've lost me somewhere.
Pardon?
Okay, you've lost me too.
Okay, sorry, okay.
Can I just ask, so on this side you have the preeminent of being the identity, and you're saying it decreases the entanglement, but you're not doing anything. If the preeminent is the identity.
So you are, because when the P of the M element is the identity, what you do is you take two copies of the state, you mix them on the beam splitter, and then you just ignore one of the output ports, right? So the point is that if you take many, many non-Gaussian states, and then you just mix them on beam splitter, and look at one of the output ports, then it will look like a Gaussian state with the same first moments as the original state. But you haven't done anything on any of the other output ports. So that is identical to our protocol, but with no post-selection, in some sense.
Why does that trace operation not appear in your definition of the recursion map? You're saying you're ignoring one of the outputs, but I didn't see any trace. And maybe you never gave us the recursion map, and that equation that you gave us was...
Yeah, I kind of... There was a slide where I said, I'm going to skip some lines of algebra, and that's where it was.
So,
after a little algebra, and that's where the recursion map was missed out. Do you want me to put it on the blackboard?
Maybe that would help.
Okay. So, Okay. So, say
is
we know...
Is it a description of the pumping protocol here? Because ultimately you're getting an expression for tau n in terms of tau 1.
Yeah. It's slightly easier for me to do it for the recursive one. That's okay. It just involves fewer subscripts. Okay, so say we have rho 2n. This is going to be equal to partial trace over, say, system 2. Rho n tensor rho n. So this is your input. You have some u, which is your beam splitter unit tree. Yeah? And then you have identity pi. Okay, so here I just mean tensor product, but a different tensor product from this one, right? So this is the recursion relation. But I want to consider square root pi rho 2n square root pi, right? And then I'm going to work out, so this is basically what tau n is up to renormalization. Then I want to work out what the characteristic function thing is for this, right? Which involves multiplying it by some operator and working out the trace. Yeah? And what was the original question? I know you wanted to see this recursion relation, but I can't remember why.
I wanted to see the case that when pi was identity, nonetheless, the overall map.
Okay. So you're happy for me to just set pi as equal to the identity for that purpose?
Sure.
Okay. That makes life a bit easier for me. Okay. So this is equal to trace of u dr u rho n tensor. Right. So this dr is exponential. It's the displacement operator. That's why I use d. It's the exponential of something that's linear in annihilation creation operators, right? So when I commute the unit tree through this displacement operator, what I end up with is two copies of a displacement operator which has been reduced by a factor of root 2. Right? So the reason for that is just that u acting on a j is equal to beam splitter will split it between the two modes, right? And then you bring the u through the trace and it cancels itself out. And then you basically have the same unitary acting on both copies of rho n, right? So that tells you that the trace is actually a product of two identical expressions like this, so we just have the same thing squared. But this is just the characteristic function, but with a root 2 instead, right? So that's one iteration of it. Yeah, so this is how it works if pi sets the identity. So the only difference if you put pi is something that isn't equal to the identity is if you consider rho n, then you can't pull the u through the pi, right? But u does commute with pi tensor pi, right? So, but u does not commute with pi tensor identity, right? So you get one of the pi's from the fact that you've made a projection, but you need a second one to symmetrize the problem so that you can commute the u through, yeah? But then what you see is that the thing that is Gaussifying is pi times rho. Does that help? Yeah. Okay, so we can set pi to be the identity, or we can set it to be a vacuum projection. Actually, for our proof, it has to be invertible, so this only is true as a limit. But there exists a kind of smooth interpolation of Gaussian states between these two. And I argue that these are interesting to look at because whilst they might have less entanglement than this, they'll have a higher success probability. Okay, so let's consider a non-Gaussian state that just looks like 0, 0 plus some amount of the 1, 1. And then we post-select using this P of M. Okay. So this is what Alice does, and Bob does the same thing as well. So this should be pi A, pi B, and then overall pi will be a combination of those two. Yeah. And then there's some variable t that controls how much post-selection we're performing. Yeah. So as t goes to 1, you have the identity. As t goes to 0, you have a vacuum projection. And this can be implemented using the 8-port homodyne detectors or using number-resolving detectors with some efficiency that is 1 minus t. Right. And then if you work out what the entanglement is of the state that you get at the end of this gasification process, we end up with this nice little graph here. So the entanglement is a function of lambda. And also, I've rescaled, I've used a variable instead of t, I've used delta, which is 1 when you're using the vacuum projection, and 0 when you're using the identity, right? So you can see that as you go to vacuum projection, this top curve zooms off towards infinity. So the bottom curve that's constant in delta is the initial entanglement. So you see that even for values of delta that are, say, around 1/2, you still converge towards some state that has more entanglement than you started off with, even though you're accepting many, many more outcomes as successful other than the vacuum, right? So, or equally, the efficiency of the detector can still be 50% and you still see gaussification towards some more entangled state, okay? So, that's all I wanted to say about entanglement just in the two-mode case. Now I'll just say a little bit about quantum repeaters. So I'm just gonna give you a description of a fairly idealized quantum repeater network, which assumes that when you send a photon along a fiber optic, for example, it suffers mostly photon loss with an attenuation length of 22 kilometers. So it loses 1/2 of its photons when it travels 22 kilometers. But also I'm gonna add one extra noise source in, which is that in the infinite limit, going along infinitely long fiber optic cable, the state becomes a thermal state which has the same occupancy as room temperature optics, right? Which is 10 to the minus 8 this should be a superscript, 10 to the minus 8 expected number of photons, right? So this is a tiny, tiny, tiny little effect, but it does actually make a quantitative difference, because if you take a pure two-mode Gaussian state, which is the kind that we're going to consider, so something with a covariance matrix of this form, where C is cosh of some squeezing parameter, so as R goes to infinity, we have a more entangled state. As R goes to 0, we have a vacuum state. If you import this state into this channel, but without the thermal component, then you'll have a non-zero amount of entanglement for infinite distance, for any distance, right? But actually putting this fairly minimal extra noise source in gives you a cap, a maximum distance that you can travel, of actually a fairly reasonable value on a terrestrial scale. So I said that we were going to use a Gaussian input state, so somehow I have to make it non-Gaussian before I put it into my Gaussifier protocol. And the typical way of doing this that is used throughout the literature is to use some degaussification, where we add and subtract photons in some combination, right? Typically, though, there's a benefit from this of not just making the state non-Gaussian, but also increasing the entanglement. So you have this kind of two-step process where you degaussify, the entanglement goes up, and then you gaussify and the entanglement goes up again. So both Alice and Bob perform the following. They take their part of the input state, they mix it on a beam splitter with some reflectivity that's finely tuned for their purpose, and they have some ancilla state that's input in a unit Fock state, and then they make a measurement and they project onto one photon, and they get some output. Right, so this is a very, very, very non-Gaussian operation. And this is probably the weakest point in the protocols. Okay, so how does our entire repeater network look? Well, you have this big distance that you want to travel, big L. We divide it up into m little slots. So here we set m is equal to 4. So we have a pair source that goes across some smaller distance, little l. Then we degaussify, which leaves us with a smaller number of copies. We gaussify. Smaller number of copies again. And then we perform some entanglement swapping operation here, which shears the entanglement across a greater distance. And we keep doing this until we have some entangled state that traverses the whole distance. We want to know whether this is actually better than just sending the state along the whole distance. Because surprisingly, despite numerous papers being written about continuous variable optics, no one had actually, and numerous papers written about distillation in the continuous variable setting, where they say, blah, 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 you know, this can be used for continuous variable repeaters. No one had actually worked out whether it would work. Okay, so here's the proof that it does. So at least in this idealized setting, what we have here is a plot of the regions where you end up with some entanglement at the end, which is bigger than zero. And this region here, which I've labeled direct, is the region where you don't have any repeater nodes. You just send the state down the channel. And it turns out that there's a cap here, just below the distance, which is equivalent to the distance from Berlin to London. So I would consider that to be a short distance for communication purposes. And even with this very, very minimal, remember I said that if you have no thermal noise, then in theory, you'll always have some amount of entanglement, no matter how much attenuation you have. So adding this small extra noise actually puts a cap on how far you can transmit entanglement. And then these other curves show how many repeater stations I'm using. And they favor having a smaller amount of squeezing, but you can get up to, at least in theory, some distance that's half the Earth's circumference. Okay.
So, I mean, that picture suggests that when you're using these repeater protocols, if you put in a lot of squeezing, then the protocol actually doesn't work.
Yes, yes. So what's going on here is that as you put in more squeezing, there are more photons. And then as you have photon attenuation, not only do you decrease the number of photons, but also there's some kind of phase noise. And there will be more phase noise than more photons there were in the original state. And the Gaussification protocol is better at dealing with the wrong photon number distribution than it is dealing with phase noise. Okay? That's the kind of rough intuition.
But if you're working, but the But if, I mean, if you're working in a regime where the direct thing would work.
Yeah.
It's still true. I mean, there's regions where the direct protocol works and the repeater protocols don't.
High squeezing regimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there.
So. Yeah, it's quite counterintuitive. I mean, the way I explain it to myself is with this kind of photon number argument, but. Somehow, when you run the degaussification followed by gaussification, the phase noise becomes more amplified.
Well, I mean, I would think that if you have a state with a lot of photons in it, and you do photon subtraction, it might not make much of a difference.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just that they have a lot of photons, they have a big photon variance.
Oh, okay.
Right? It depends how you're squeezing it, I guess.
Yeah, I've remembered as well another thing. So swapping is suboptimal, right? In the sense that if you ask what's the best thing to do, assuming that you just have attenuation, is it just transmit a state directly, or is it transmit it partially and then do a swapping operation? So actually, in the discrete variable case, by which I mean if you just have like zero or one photons and you do this, then what you see is that if you swap and you use a particular post-selective swap, you actually perform some distillation at the same time, right? And you can achieve further distances by using the swap. But actually, the swap here decreases the amount of entanglement relative to the direct transmission. So this is kind of like a weak point. So the more swaps you use, you shouldn't use a swap unless you really have to, right? So what's happening in this regime is that because there are more photons, the state has suffered more phase noise. But when you try to use a swap, you add more noise, and that's what kills the entanglement.
Okay.
So this is the penultimate slide, and I just want to comment on how, because it's the principal application, I've been focusing on the two-mode case, but everything I've said holds for any number of modes, right? So in particular, if you have this three-mode state, then you can gaussify this and have some genuine tripartite Gaussian entanglement at the end, but also you can gaussify a single-mode state. Now, obviously, there's no entanglement, but what's happening here is this has some small amount of squeezing, and we're only using linear optics. In theory, if we use nonlinear optics, then we could just squeeze the state more by applying a unitary squeezer. But there's a limit to how well we can squeeze in the lab. So this process is an alternative route to achieving high squeezing as well. Okay. And that's the main core of the talk. The closing remarks I want to make just to kind of what we said is that there are many ways to gaussify, not just these one or two protocols that existed before, and that even when we're using measurements, so when pi is not the identity, you can apply central limit theorem techniques. I find working in phase space to be more intuitive than working in Fock space. So I've also hopefully convinced you that it's at least possible that CV systems could achieve long-distance quantum crypto, which was not previously shown. But one thing that we really need to know is what the key rates are for these things, because I've just said it's in principle possible. I haven't said anything about what the rates would be. So I have some sufficient conditions for when this expectation value that I said everything boils down to actually does converge to a correct value, but it would be nice to have maybe neater conditions or know when the conditions are necessary, sufficient and necessary. And I haven't said anything about rates of convergence, like can we guarantee that the state would have converged within a certain number of time steps? Okay, that's everything.
Questions?
So, the central limit theorem.
Yeah.
I mean, is it fair to say that the kind of the generic statement then is that if you have many copies of something, it's kind of approximately Gaussian?
If you have many copies, I'm not sure what you mean. If you have many copies of something, then it will be as If you have many copies of a non-Gaussian state, then the joint state will still be non-Gaussian.
Sure.
But
you said the central limit. I mean, so what is the intuitive content of this non-commutative central limit theorem?
So maybe I should. Maybe if I say a bit more about how it works for the case where pi is set to be the identity, right? So this is a scenario where you have many copies of the state and you pass it through some large beam splitter network. And you pick the unitary in such a way that the characteristic function is essentially the same for each one of the output ports, the reduced output ports, right? Because you've applied a unitary, the output, the global output state must be as non-Gaussian as the input state. But if you look at any single one of the output ports, then it will look Gaussian.
Right.
So where's the non-Gaussianity?
Like
so, pardon?
That's kind of like the average for the regular.
It's kind of like the average. That's the other way of thinking about it, is that this unitary, it maps the, say, X operator to be the X operator, but equally weighted across all of the states. So if you look at what's happening in the Heisenberg picture, you're just mapping the quadrature operators to ones that are equally weighted. So that's the sense in which you can think about it as being sampling over the average of the initial input states. But the non-Gaussianity is hidden in the correlations between the output states.
Sure.
So you shift. So the beam splitter network kind of hides the non-Gaussianity in the correlations between the reduced density matrices.
Right. So then I guess my question is, what does this do in the finite dimensional case? So if you do kind of the same thing in some sense?
Yeah. There's got to be a finite dimensional analog of it.
I mean, maybe you just get maximum mixed states or something. But...
No, I'm not sure.
For the analog Gaussian states, you could say you're working with Q-trace, the stabilizer states.
Yeah, well, that's,
not the
that's what I was wondering. But it doesn't.
So you're wondering, start with non-stabilizer
kind
states,
of impossible.
Do the marginals start looking more like stabilizer?
Yeah.
You get like stabilizerification.
I mean, the thing is, though, in the infinite dimensional case, you have some operator that has an infinite number of eigenvalues that are continuous and go from minus infinity to infinity.
Right.
And then you map it unitarily to some sum of operators, right, divided by square root of n. And then this will obviously also have a range that goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. And to get but then if you take some stabilizer operator, like x or z, and then you ask, can I map this to some sum of stabilizers, then obviously the summation is going to have some bigger spectrum of eigenvalues. So...
Well,
it's not clear to me if that will.
I don't think it's right to take the sum to the sum. I mean, because when you, the poly operators, finite dimensional poly operators, are analogous to displacement operators.
Yeah.
But the sum then is kind of product on the displacement operators, right? It's a little different algebra, so it's not totally fair thing to say. But I don't think the sum in the continuous variable case is quite analogous to a sum of operators in the finite dimensional case. So I don't think that's quite the right analogy. But this was my thought, that if you just kind of take this obvious analogy, that's what you'd say, but it seems somehow unlikely.
I mean, are you thinking about this kind of qubit or qdit discrete Wigner function picture? And
yeah, that would be
if you could get some kind of Gaussification on that level. Yeah. I don't know what a Gaussian even looks like in the discrete variable picture, though.
Well, I mean, so normally stabilizer states are the discrete finite dimensional analog of Gaussian states.
Yeah.
It's not 100% correspondence, but
yeah.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
But I mean, on the other hand, we like one big difference that we know is that you can do distillation with purely stabilizer operations.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe it just doesn't apply somehow.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly wouldn't use any of these protocols in the discrete variable case where you've got stabilizer operations, but. I did try and think about this problem of whether there was some analog of the central limit theorem for discrete Wigner functions before, but I can't remember what conclusion I came to. Sorry. I'll tell you if I think of anything this week. Hey, Rob.
So I'm thinking if instead of Gaussian operations, you had thermal operations, and it was implausible to me that you might find a similar result, that if you look at some subsystem, it's more thermal because its athermal properties have sort of gone into the correlations among many systems. And when I take the marginal, it looks more thermal.
Yeah.
And then that reminds me of all this work on showing that for typical states, their marginals are generically thermal.
Yeah.
I'm just curious whether this is a connection you've thought about at all.
So, yeah, it's true that, okay, so if I take many copies of my state and I apply some unit tree that looks like the beam splitter unit tree, I think this even works if it's nearest neighbor, then you'll get, then they'll thermalize in the Fock basis. And then if you had some different unit tree, then they would thermalize in some other basis. Like if I squeeze the beam splitter unit trees in some sense. That doesn't say anything about typicality. Here's a statement that you can make about typicality. But So you're thinking in analog to these kind of, are you thinking about random matrix theory where you say, take a random unitary matrix and then evolve the state and then look at the reduced density matrix and it always looks like close to the identity? What I think is true, but I've not tried to prove it, is that any Gaussian channel is also described by a unitary matrix, but say over M modes, it's just an M by M unitary matrix. Right, so nowhere near as big as the actual Hilbert space. And then the unit tree that we want to use essentially looks like something that has all of the entries that are the same absolute value, but different phases dotted around. If you take a random unitary matrix, then you'll end up with something that's close to this. Right. So if you have a random Gaussian unit tree and you evolve any state, then I think you can make similar conclusions that the reduced density matrices thermalize. And this is something that I mentioned to people actually last week, and everyone was like, yeah, sounds believable. Haven't actually tried to prove it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.